This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Hello. Welcome to the second episode of the Sophocles' Antigone in 2019 podcast. My name is Dylan, and there's been a slight change to the scheduling of episodes. So, instead of Rachel discussing the Paradox, today I'll be picking up the discussion of the text with verses 191 to 210, just a little further forward than Dr. Beck left off at the end of episode 1. I'll give a general summary of the passage and where it's situated within the work as a whole, and then take a look at some aspects of the speech of Creon and how they relate to a similar passage by Antigone herself. I'll then look at the chorus's response to Creon and how it differs from a typical Sophoclean response. Finally, I'll provide some thoughts on my experience with Teacher of the Day and how it shaped my approach to ancient Greek. Up to this point in the Antigone, we have had the prologue between Antigone and her sister Ismene, a section which Dr. Beck talks about in episode 1. Now this is followed by the Paradox, or the introductory choral ode, celebrating the end of the battles and deaths in Thebes, brought about by the seven against Thebes. Then, from verses 162 to 210, is the speech of the Theban leader Creon. In the half up to verse 191, he details his rationale for protecting the city, concluding this half with a ship of the state metaphor. Now, this is where our passage begins. These principles, Creon says, are what guides him to strengthen the city. Now listen as he states his edict concerning the sons of Oedipus, a sibling of those principles, he calls this edict, regarding the son Eteocles, the one who perished defending Thebes. He is to be given all the funeral rites and accordances for the dead. For the brother Polynices, though, Creon calls him an exile, one seeking to burn down his homeland and native gods, and to drink the blood of his once fellow people, and to lead away the Thebans in chains. For this Polynices, Creon declares that there shall be no burial, but that the corpse is to be left in the open for the birds and the dogs, to be a horrible sight for all. This, he says, is right, for he shall never have the wicked honored before the good, and that those who are good to the city are to be honored in life and in death. The chorus responds at 211, saying that this is pleasing to you, and that you, Creon, at any rate, can use the laws of Thebes over the living and the dead. I want to focus first on verses 194 to 206. This is where Creon describes the dead sons of Oedipus and the fates of their corpses. Here, anyone watching the play would gradually recall Antigone's early description to Ismene of Creon's proclamation concerning the bodies at verses 23 through 30 in the Paradox, in the prologue. In both, a shorter section describing the fate of Eteocles is presented, followed by a more extended section on Polynices. While at times the syntax varies, there are several instances of the same words appearing, sometimes even within the same position in the line of the two passages. Some examples of this include Eteocleamen and Aeon in the beginning of lines, and Kokousaitina, or Necrois, at the ends of lines. Now, of course, there are still significant differences between the two passages. Notably, Creon's description of Polynices includes from verses 199 to 203 a vivid four-line description where he paints Polynices as an exile who comes to Thebes to set fire from the top down his fatherland, and his native gods. Creon, Polynices is like a fiend coming to lap up the blood of the people that were once his. Why would Creon include such a description of Polynices? And why would Antigone not do so? I see this four-line passage as his attempt to make clear the necessity of his edict, which he describes in verse 191 as a sibling to the principles that he wishes to strengthen the city with. With this reasoning for the passage, it makes sense that Sophocles chose not to mirror the passage in Antigone's speech. Her reasoning for Polynices' burial does not rely on his actions while alive, unlike the edict of Creon against such a burial. Sophocles contrasts the two even further by giving Creon a less graphic description of what shall be done to Polynices' corpse. Creon does not state that the corpse will be a sweet treasury for the birds and dogs, as we see in Antigone's earlier lines. Instead, he simply states that the corpse is to be eaten by the same animals and to be tormented. So, why would Sophocles do this? He could have just as well excluded from these lines from Creon and simply had him make mention of his decree that Polynices not be buried. After all, the audience has already heard from Antigone the details. Now, there's a few ideas for why he would do so. First, he could simply be reminding the audience that although the specifics aren't entirely necessary for an audience that would likely already know the story of the death of Eteocles and Polynices, and the story of the Seven against Thebes. Instead, Sophocles could be seeking to exaggerate the parallels between Antigone and Creon. Through common words, Sophocles has Creon echoing Antigone, echoing Creon's own decree. The lines between the two characters blur ever so slightly. Between this and the chorus's initial allying with Creon, something typically occurring to the tragic hero in the beginning of the play, I see Sophocles as trying to leave the hero of the play in doubt. There isn't any clear pre-existing stories about Antigone attempting to bury the body of Polynices, and a less extreme version of Creon's decree would be understandable to ancient Athenians. By this point in the play, an attending audience might be asking themselves, who am I supposed to be empathizing with? Who am I supposed to be relating to? Who is the hero of this story? A student in class proposed a different interpretation. They said that this is Creon's attempt to solidify his control. Creon finds himself on uneven footing after the battle with the Seven against Thebes. And so now he provides these long-winded passages, providing more detailed rationale for his actions in an attempt to legitimize them in the eyes of the chorus, and by extension, the entire city of Thebes. I think one should keep this interpretation of Creon in mind for later passages that display him acting more and more autocratic and stubborn in his approach to leading the city, especially in verses 736 to 738, in his dialogue with Hymen, his son, where he postulates that the city belongs to its ruler. This, I think, is a far cry from the Creon that we see in the passage right now. This passage about the sons of Oedipus and its parallels with Antigone's previous speech in the prologue also highlight the meta-theatrical nuance of the play. Neither the chorus nor Creon were on stage for Antigone's words in the prologue. These parallels between the two speeches are for the audience alone to catch and for them alone to interpret, not the characters of the play. To me, this stands out as a moment in the text where the performance aspect of the work becomes clear and important. Imagining yourself in the amphitheater with characters now speaking words so reminiscent of those spoken previously by completely different characters holding very different ideas must have been jarring. It's an interesting comparison, and one only given for the audience to interpret. Before talking about the experience of being teacher of the day, I do want to turn to the chorus's response to Creon's speech, starting at verse 211. Paraphrasing, they respond, "This is pleasing to you, Creon, to do with the enemies and friends to the city." Now, normally, the responses of the chorus and dialogue sections, like what we have here, are not very interesting. We would typically expect them to probably just agree with whatever Creon is saying prior to this. Their response here seems to differ from that norm, though. Here, the chorus is not agreeing with Creon that his edict is right, only that it is within his power to issue such an edict if it pleases him. The first word of their response is soi, or to you. The emphasis here is now placed not on the city, but onto what is pleasing most to Creon himself. Their reluctance to agree with him, but to still be at his side, foreshadows some of the later remarks of Antigone that the chorus does not find Creon correct. Instead, she says, they are merely afraid of what he would do if they were to dissent openly against him and his edict. Now, overall, the teacher of the day experience was incredibly rewarding. Preparing the passage with greater focus allowed the subtleties and connections of the individual lines in the play as a whole to really come out. I know I've gained a better understanding of how Sophocles' text is never shallow, and that as one continues to peel back its layers, even more is revealed. Reading later in the text, I can see how my approach has shifted since being teacher of the day. Now, I'm not just trying to translate the lines, but trying to understand their place in the text and how they serve the play as a whole. This came as a bit of a shock, just because I think it's easy for us at first to think that if one can translate the lines, they must already understand them. Although after this experience, I can certainly say that's not true. In the next episode of Sophocles' Antigone in 2019 podcast, we're going to have Cassie picking up right where I left off, looking at verses 215 to 242. Here, she's going to focus more on the latter part of this passage and on the character of the guard who's introduced and the oddities that such a character can bring to a tragedy, or at least that they do bring to the Antigone. Again, my name is Dylan, and this was episode 2 of the podcast Sophocles' Antigone in 2019. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to respond in the comment section below. Thank you.